It wasn't even worthy of that.
What a great way to open our recording.
If you're the type of person that makes sandwiches with three pieces of bread, let's make a club.
Okay.
Where's my crickets?
Where are your crickets?
They're in my phone, almost dead phone.
We can edit in crickets.
Just remember to mention that this is a short podcast.
Oh.
Yes.
Due to show.
This is a short podcast.
This is a short podcast.
It is.
That's what I think. Do you want
me
to save
stop
this
recording,
for later?
Nope.
If we stop recording right now, it'll be the shortest one yet.
Indeed.
That it will.
It'll end before it begins.
We're at a minute 30.
Ooh. We've wasted 90 seconds of everybody's time.
The best part was we could pretend it's like actually a joke and turn off the recording and everyone would go, oh crap, they were serious. First time for everything.
Win. Yeah, I'm a boring stamp collector. I'm a bookkeeper. Bookkeepers are so boring. You can't even find really good jokes about bookkeepers.
Don't,
they just substitute
please, no.
blonde this, jokes.
That's
please,
why fart jokes
don't,
are so
please
funny.
Don't challenge him.
I'll find notary jokes.
Yeah, a notary or a bookkeeper. And the only bookkeeper jokes I ever found were blonde jokes. They substitute bookkeeper for blonde.
Okay, let's count it down.
Is anyone going to count?
I'm going to. I'm getting in the zone.
She's trying to remember how.
Diva. Yeah, that's it.
Oh, she just got that.
Bookkeeper's trying to remember how to count. Great.
She just got that.
Yeah, I love the logic behind me being
hopefully,
a bookkeeper. You
hopefully
know?
Your boss doesn't listen to this show.
He might. Oh, he knows me. It's like, you know, when he interviewed me, it's like, well, let's see, she's got a bad attitude and bad at numbers. Hey, bookkeeper. Brilliant. Okay, enough of that.
10, 6, 5, 3, 1.
Go.
Woo-hoo. All right, serious. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Hi, I'm Mark Reisner, president of the American Stamp Dealers Association, and you are listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
Look at them, madam. Have you ever in your entire life seen anything so beautiful?
I'm sorry, I don't know anything about stamps.
This is the gentle art of philately, otherwise known as stamp collecting. Here's a pile of stamps carefully culled from swap meets and garage sales.
Rufus, what are you thinking of?
Oh, I was just thinking of all the years I've wasted collecting stamps.
Oh, like stamp collecting. Now, that's all right. That's quite a nice hobby, that.
Yes, but it's not enough. Don't you understand? I'm lonely. I'm so terribly lonely.
And look at this. It's a Bolivian airplane. Now, it says it's worth 8 cents, but really, it's worth 12. Now, we'll just paste this very carefully into the book, and that's where it belongs.
A stamp museum?
Oh, stamps! Those are for snail mail! Stamps rule! Suck!
Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 86.
I'm Cash.
This is Tom.
I'm Scott.
And I'm your host, Dawn. This week, we'll be taking some listener emails and comments, some stamp stories, and our expert topic will be a short discussion on something that Scott found interesting.
Yes, I did. Yes, yes, yes.
You found something interesting.
I did.
Awesome.
It was shiny.
First time for everything.
So, our listener comments. Remember that our email address is bluepaper@gradingmatters.com. So a few comments we got from our friend, Stan Iceland. Stan and Katrina are awesome. We had dinner with them last night, and they're so much fun. And we were talking about the podcast last night.
Mm-hmm.
Commenting on our negotiating podcast, episode 83, Stan said that the discussion was all good except for the dealer who you want to build a relationship with. So what do you guys think about relationship building with a stamp dealer?
Well, it's good.
I think that the, some of the negotiating points that we made were more adversarial.
Mercenary.
Yeah, mercenary. And if you're, if you have a local dealer that you're going to be, you know, sitting there and talking and stuff like that, you probably don't want to be as adversarial in your negotiations.
Well, that's true. I mean, if you develop a relationship with a dealer over time, they're going to give you probably better and better discounts as time goes on. And that in itself is a negotiating tactic.
Yeah, another thing though, even if they don't, I don't think they really give you discounts, but what they do is they price things much closer. They don't try to, you know, they know where the haggle factor is and they're not going to go for it. They're going to say, you know, I bought this for $100, you can have it for $110, and it's done.
You know, I've got a relationship similar to that with a number of dealers. And, you know, when I see something I like, they don't necessarily tell me what they paid for it, but they give me a price. And it's usually almost expected to be a no-haggle price.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm the one throwing out the number, then that's kind of a haggle point. But if they're throwing out the number, then it's, you know, after a while it becomes a no-haggle price.
Yeah.
It's like, this is, you know, you can have it for this. And you just kind of know that you're getting the best deal that he can give you, given his set of circumstances, what he paid for it, how long he's had it, and all of that. So at some point, your negotiating turns into a no-haggle price, and you just don't have to deal with that anymore with that particular dealer.
Now, that being said, first of all, it takes a long time to get to that point.
It takes years to get to that point.
Don't figure you're going to go in there and say, hey, yeah, okay, I'm going to stop haggling with this guy. He's a great guy, and I've known him for 2 weeks.
And I've seen him at every stamp show for the last 6 months, and I've bought stuff from him every time I've seen him. But that doesn't mean that he's your best buddy.
Right.
You may be a good customer, things like that. It's when you start to have the stamp dealer as a friend, you go out to dinner, you do things other than just buying and selling stamps with him, that's when at a point where friendship kind of enters into it, and then those kind of things occur.
Yeah.
It's time for hashtag stamp stories. Women in postal history. The first woman on a U.S. stamp. The first stamp specifically to honor a woman was the 8-cent Martha Washington stamp issued in 1902. Now, I've got a few facts about Martha Washington.
Cool. Let me guess. Number one was her first name was Martha.
You put that together.
Well, I was going to say she was married to Washington, but that's actually has a chance of being one of your facts.
It might be. Martha Washington was born June 2nd, 1731. She was actually a little bit older than George.
Ooh, cradle robber.
Mm. She was born Martha Dandridge. And she was born in Virginia. Unlike most women in Virginia in the early 1700s, she knew how to read and write.
I'm not impressed so far.
I know you're not impressed so far. But we're getting to the impressive stuff.
Oh,
now,
okay.
Now, if you said she was born as a man, then I would have been impressed.
I would have been confused. Her first marriage to Daniel Custis in 1750 produced 4 children. She outlived all of her kids, which is just really sad.
Hmm.
She was a very young widow when she met George Washington and married him January 6th in 1759. And her and 2 of her children moved with them to Mount Vernon. This was something about her I did not know. I thought this was fascinating. Is that Martha stayed with George Washington's winter encampments throughout much of the Revolutionary War.
I never saw that on any of the movies.
Me neither.
Yeah.
Yeah, you saw all guys.
Yeah.
So, yeah, she was there with him at the winter encampments.
So she was a camp follower.
Yes, she was.
We'll just leave it at that.
We'll just leave it at that.
Well, technically, wives followed the camp, and they were called camp followers also.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And, well, obviously, George Washington being the first president of the United States.
No, he was not.
I knew he was going to start in on this.
Well, of course, it's one of his mm-hmm. pet peeves.
Yeah, you have your choice of first presidents. You can pick Peyton Randolph. You can pick Hanson. You can go way out and pick John Hancock. But under all definitions, George Washington, not the first president of the United States.
But about Martha being the first lady.
Well,
Oh.
Were any of the others married?
I think they were all. I know Peyton Randolph was married. I'm pretty sure John Hancock was married. I don't know. I don't know that much about Hanson. But the thing is, the title of First Lady, I think, did occur at that point. They didn't call anybody First Lady before that. And and in actuality, did they call Martha Washington First Lady, or was that a term that was developed later?
Well, it must have been probably later, because she had been addressed as Lady Washington, or as Our Lady Presidentess.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. Who was the first lady? We know George Washington wasn't the first president, but who was the first lady? First lady.
I'm giving it to Martha.
The first lady.
Mm-hmm. How about this? A year after George Washington passed away, died, Martha freed all of his slaves.
Yeah, there's an interesting story about that. George Washington was going to free all his slaves upon his death. But then he said, no, they're all going to be freed upon Martha Washington's death. So George Washington dies. Then there's like 80 slaves hanging around waiting for this old lady to die. You know, they're all kind of looking at her out of the corner of their eyes and stuff. Martha was probably sitting there going, you know, this is not a really good situation to be in. I think I'm going to go ahead and release them early. Being surrounded by 80 slaves waiting for you to die, you know, one of them might want to help you along a little bit.
Martha died on May 22nd, 1802. And
1802?
1802. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes.
And if she was still alive today, she would be...
Really, really old.
No, clawing at the coffin trying to get out.
Well, she and I share the same birth date.
Oh, really? Ooh.
Yes, we do.
I didn't catch that when you were reading it.
No.
You should have.
No, my birthday, her death day.
Oh, that's morbid.
That is morbid. And then, well, my favorite fact of all is that her great-granddaughter, Mary Custis, married Robert E. Lee.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Nice. Keeping history all together there.
Yes.
All in the family.
Absolutely. Yeah, Robert E. Lee was a very big fan. Actually, his father, I think it was, Light Horse Harry Lee.
Uh-huh.
You know, knew Washington. He grew up, you know, absolutely adoring him to the point of marrying his great-grandchild. So there you go.
Sounds good to me.
Mm-hmm.
Martha Washington was the first lady.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah. And actually, there's a thing. It says George Washington's wife was the first to be given the title of lady by the press, as in Lady Washington.
There you go. Because
mm-hmm.
I hope it doesn't say there that George Washington was first president.
It doesn't, because it's about first ladies, not about presidents.
Good. I don't have to ridicule your website.
And now for Cash's corrections. Cash?
Oh, we're done.
Well, we're done. Ready to stop recording?
I just
recording?
Wanted to move on, okay? I was just like, okay, I'm done with this.
Well, actually, a little follow-up to what you were just talking about. Calvin just put up a new YouTube, everybody. It's the Battle of Five Forks, and it addresses the Battle of Five Forks stamp on the souvenir, or the souvenir. Is it a souvenir sheet? What do you call that?
It's a Civil War
sheet. Yeah, the Civil War sheet. It's not a souvenir sheet.
It's just a Civil War commemorative.
It's a big format sheet or something. But anyway, check us out on our YouTube channel, Stamp Show Here Today, and the Battle of Five Forks. The second thing is we won't have any mention whatsoever on this podcast of Big Mike. Except for that one we just did. And maybe a couple others later on. The third one, this is a story that I found very fascinating. It starts with, like, imagine this. And picture yourself back in 1850s. And mail is now 3 cents. You can transport stuff via railroads. Commerce gets really easy to do. But here's something that we kind of poo-poo today, but it was really a big thing back then. How do you do business with strangers? How do you trust people in the 1850s? Now, you go down to the corner market. The guy knows where you live. They know your kids. They know what's going on your farm. But what about the person in the next state or three states over or on the West Coast versus the East Coast? And what they had, and it started in my favorite time period, the 1850s, they had the mercantile agencies. And these are agencies that kept track on people, and they basically sort of spied on people, and they'd send postcards to the local merchants and say, hey, what do you know about Joe Blow here? You know, how good is he? And one of the earliest ones was the publication for getting this information was the Mercantile Journal of New York. And an interesting aside to it is the founder of that company, his name was Louis Tappan, and he was the lawyer who defended the slaves on the slave ship Amistad. If anybody saw that movie, he is the Stellan John Skarsgård character, and I know I pronounced that wrong, but he's the Norwegian guy that was in the ABBA movie.
Mamma Mia.
He was one of the three fathers in Mamma Mia. He was the Norwegian father in Mamma Mia, if you've seen that. Anyway, so this guy was famous. He started the mercantile agencies, and I thought that was incredibly interesting because, you know, A, this is my part of history, but B, when you think about it, we use eBay. eBay has a rating system. eBay has a lot of safeguards, but you don't have this, obviously, in the 1850s. And how did they deal with strangers? People can find covers from the mercantile agencies all the way up until the 1920s. And as a matter of fact, this Louis Tappan's mercantile agency that made the Mercantile Journal of New York, that eventually became Dun & Bradstreet. So this is something that has current day references as well as 1850s postal history references and things like that. So this is just a story that I wanted to forward on because I thought it was very interesting.
It's actually called the Mercantile Agency.
That's what I thought it was called.
Yeah, it didn't have a name. It was the Mercantile Agency.
Yeah, by Louis Tappan, right?
Yeah. It was the precursor to Dun & Bradstreet.
Yep. If you do some research on this on Wikipedia, you'll find that this is a fascinating story. You find a lot of corner cards and postcards where the agency was mailing people to get information. They also served as collection agencies. It's a very, very interesting how do you deal with strangers sort of topic.
Peyton Randolph's the first president of the United States.
Technically not. Because here's the argument. Peyton Randolph was the first president of the Continental Congress for a place that was not called the United States.
Peyton Randolph.
Yes.
When delegates voted in Philadelphia for the first Continental Congress, they elected Peyton Randolph as the first president of the territory known as the United States.
Yes, but it wasn't called the United States until John Hancock three presidents later.
This doesn't say that, so.
I know. The story basically is, do you call it when the first Continental Congress was up, when they first called it the United States? When they first voted for something, or when the war ended? Or do you do like everybody else does and say, when they drafted this piece of paper many, many years after the United States started and many, many presidents later, and we voted George Washington in, is he the first president? And if you want to get correct, George Washington was the first president under our current Constitution, but was not the first president in the United States.
No, I found a stupid site that's clickbait and has actually the 14 presidents before Washington.
Oh, 14 presidents. Yeah, so then they'll list all the Congress plus all the Article of Confederation ones.
Yeah, Peyton Randolph, Henry Middleton.
Yep.
We're going to give you 14 on 7 different pages.
Yeah, well, I'm surprised it isn't on 28 pages in each one he gives you.
John Hancock, but it doesn't say John Hancock
But what was John Hancock's title? What was the name of the territory?
Well, this doesn't say. It just says the third president was rebel leader and merchant John Hancock.
Yeah, but if you look at what he is the president of, it's president of the United States of the colonies of Britain, blah, 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 something like that. There's a bunch of words after it. But he was the first president of a place that actually had the words United States in it.
Four was Henry Lawrence.
Yep.
John Jay.
You want to do this when we're not recording?
Samuel Huntington. Mm-hmm. Oh, my day's already wasted. I don't care.
Well, then I'm going to take a nap.
He's going to take a nap.
Oh, my God. Who the hell cares?
Okay, let's start the expert topic.
Yeah, let's go to the expert topic. And now our expert topic, hinging. Hinging on no gun stamps and in ungum selvage.
Well, everybody hopefully knows what a hinge is, right?
Oh, yeah.
Guys, what's a hinge?
A piece of cellophane with glue on one side that you lick, you apply to the back of the stamp.
Does
to
it have
form
to be
a
cellophane?
Hinge. I'm sure it doesn't have to be, but I have never seen one that wasn't.
Well, before they had,
just hold the door open.
Yeah,
hinges.
Before we had what we call hinges now, which are the glassine, small pieces of glassine with gum on it that are folded over. They used selvage from the sheets of stamps. Because they had gum on them as well. And they would fold those over, attach a piece to the album page, and then attach the other piece to the stamp. And you sometimes can find old stamps with the remains of that type of hinge on the stamp.
Are we going to get into the theoretical debate of what a hinge is here?
No. No, but it's just interesting to see how hinges have developed throughout the history of stamp collecting. And from that and using iron glue and things like that to paste your stamps into an album or just buying mint stamps and licking and sticking them
Don't use tape.
To using cellophane tape and scotch tape and all this other stuff. And then the argument, well, do I use a mount and hinging on never hinged stamps and things like that. But anyway... really what I wanted to talk about was hinging on no gum stamps. If you have a stamp that was issued without gum and you hinge it into an album, you take it out, you remove the hinge, is it still a hinged stamp? It didn't have gum on it originally, so why would you consider it a hinged stamp?
Well, philosophically, yes, it is a hinged stamp, and yes, it makes absolutely zero impact on the value of the stamp.
Right. Because if you do that, you should just soak the stamp anyway and get rid of any hinge gum that may be left so that the stamp, again, has no gum.
Technically, you could have a hinged used stamp.
Yes.
And that hinging has zero impact on the value of the stamp.
Correct.
Because you would just soak off whatever was there, and it would be impossible to determine that it was ever prior hinged.
Right. So then we get to things like plate blocks. Well, for U.S. plate blocks, in many countries, plate blocks, when they exist, are fully gummed. In the United States, a lot of early plate blocks have an area in selvage that where the gum was not applied. It was just applied enough to cover the stamps, and then they didn't really care about the selvage area. And there are notes in the catalog that specifically state that if there is hinging evidence in these ungummed areas, then you have to consider the plate block as hinged, not never hinged. But in reality, most dealers will tell you that the plate block is never hinged, even if there's a hinge remnant in the ungummed selvage, because there was no gum there to disturb, and therefore it does have full, undisturbed original gum. And so the question is, well, is the catalog out of step with reality, or what's going on here? And the reality is, if you're careful, you can remove the hinge remnant and any evidence of hinging out of the ungummed salvage and restore the block to its pristine condition.
If you're careful, and on a scale of 1 to 10 careful, you need to be like a 4. It's not like this is major science. You need to just make sure you don't get any water on the glue.
But you
got to
remember, a lot of people aren't careful, or they don't have the patience, or they don't have the manual dexterity to do this.
Well, which is why I said 4 instead of, you know, lower.
But it shouldn't be difficult if you're careful. I would talk with a dealer or an experienced collector and discuss techniques before trying it. But absolutely, if you want to remove hinges out of the ungummed salvage, that should be your option.
Yep. And I think you're foolish not to do it, because if you have a hinge mark in the ungummed salvage, you may lose half the value of the plate block. Whereas a little water, a little care, a little drawing properly, and you will be a never hinged plate block. Why don't we just give a little technique of how we do it? I mean, me and you probably both do it the same way.
Sure, go for it.
Yeah, well, I use a sponge or something like that. I do not obviously pour water on the back of the plate block, but I'll take a sponge and I'll put it on top of the hinge mark, and I'll let the residue from the sponge seep down, and I'll be really super careful. I don't want any water whatsoever to hit the gum. And I'll just let it sit there, and it'll sit there for, you know, 10 minutes or so. And then I will lift off the sponge, and I'll just take, you know, some, like my stamp tongs or something, and remove whatever was there. If it was something large, I might get a little razor blade to sort of rub it over the top, not scrape it, but just rub it over the top to remove whatever residual was there.
I don't even do that. I don't get razor blades anywhere near my stamps.
Well, no, I was just saying like a straight edge.
But I don't even do that. Oh. I use tongs specifically because all of the edges are rounded. If there's residue there that needs to come off, then I would reapply the sponge. I would let the item dry, and then I would reapply the sponge, because that's supposed to be water-soluble adhesive.
Yes, I misspoke. So, I would remove everything off the back after it was well soaked. It's not like if there was some residue, I would scrape it off then. I would continue to get it wet until everything from the hinge mark was removed.
Yeah, but you have to also be very careful, because you don't want to rub it aggressively, because once the paper gets wet, then it becomes soft and much easier to abrade.
Yeah, that is very true.
And you definitely don't want to cause an abrasion, which would be basically a thin in the salvage area. That would also be bad.
Yeah. Now for the parks, you know, I sell a lot of stuff on eBay. And I remember once, this was a while ago, I sold a park set. And I did not describe it.
This is the imperforated National Parks.
This is imperforated no-gum park set from 1935.
5 or 6, yeah.
And it has no gum. And I sold the set, and the person gave me a big emails talking about how he's returning it because the 8 center is hinged. And he actually mailed me back the 8 center. I put it in a glass of water. I soaked the hinge off. I dried it, and I mailed it back to him. And I explained to him that, you know, when stamps are no gum, there is no premium for never hinged. Like I said, it's not whether it's hinged or not. It's the fact that there is absolutely zero impact on value. You can have, like I said, you can have a hinged used stamp. Doesn't matter about the value. You can have a hinged no gum stamp. Doesn't have any impact whatsoever on the value. You have a gum stamp, you have a big impact on value.
Absolutely. Now, one other thing with hinging, when you're talking about the modern self-adhesive stamps, when do you call it hinged? Obviously, and I don't know why, but I've seen people actually take hinges and apply it to the backing paper and hinge a mint stamp into their album. And I don't understand why you wouldn't put it in a mount, because now you've basically hinged your stamp.
Yeah.
And if I were to look at that, I would say this is no longer a mint never hinged stamp. even though technically the adhesive part of the stamp is still under the backing paper, and that's okay, you've actually marked the backing paper, and a lot of time our backing paper has information printed on the back. And so it does affect the value somewhat. I mean, obviously you can still peel off the backing paper and stick it on the letter, but it does. It definitely then becomes a hinged stamp.
I guarantee you in 25 years, a stamp that had a hinge on the backing paper is going to be considered hinged. No question about it.
Well, I already consider them hinged.
Yeah, but today, you know, it's nobody kind of cares because it's postage still.
Well, in 20 years, it'll still be postage because they're mostly forever stamps.
Good point. Good point. No, I had a U.S. collection, and I hinged all the stamps in because they're all cheap stamps. I mean, there's nothing wrong with it. Just collect any way you want. But realize that you are affecting the value.
Oh, absolutely. I still know collectors today who actually have bought never-hinged stamps and hinged them into an album. I don't think... I've only been collecting for 20 or 25 years, and I don't think I've ever done that.
Yeah. Well, I mean...
But I do know collectors that have.
The ones that I was hinging in were 3 cent and above, you know.
Still, doesn't matter.
Yeah, I don't want
it to... It just speaks to the time when
The mounts cost more than the stamps did.
Yeah, yeah, they do. And they did, yeah. But I just couldn't bring myself to hinge... Even a 3 cent commemorative stamp, I couldn't bring myself to hinge it.
You're so much better than I am.
Well, talking about hinges, are they basically all the same? Or are there hinges that are, say, better than others? Any one that you would recommend?
Well, there are some that are better. Ideally, what we try and shoot for is to have the hinge be peelable, meaning that you stick a stamp in an album and... If you put it in the wrong place, you don't want to immediately remove it. You want to wait until the hinge dries and then remove it. And hopefully the hinge you've used is peelable, which means it peels off the stamp without bringing any of the stamp with it. And it should peel off of the album page as well. Unfortunately, modern gum has not met the historical peelability test. And my personal opinion is it has to do with the fact that these older adhesive washes were biologic based. They were made from horses and whatever other animals they turned into glue. And nowadays it's all synthetic. And the synthetic adhesive is stronger and just doesn't peel like the animal-based gums used to.
And of course the best hinge is
it's the old Denison's. Yeah.
So it gives 3M a new market for their Command strip line.
Yeah. Well, the Denison's hinges, they've tried to duplicate and they never got the recipe correct, but Denison's hinges, and you think hinges, you know, you can spend $25-$30 for a bag of Denison's hinges. I mean, when you're lucky, you'll find one for like $10 or $15. And this is when a regular bag of hinges might cost you $3.
Yeah, I remember when I started, you know, I'd buy the Foldo hinges, which you really can't find either. And those were pretty tough to remove. But I'd buy those for, you know, 89, 99 cents. They were less than a buck. And now most stamp hinges are anywhere from $2.50 to $3 and up.
Yeah.
And obviously, again, if you want the good Denison's, you're talking generally in the $12 to $20 range for a package. Well, I think we've been stuck enough on that, so.
Don,
why don't you lead us out?
Oh, I'll lead us out. Thank you for joining us for episode 86. This has been Cash, Scott, Tom, and I'm your host, Dawn. You can reach us with your questions or comments at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, or leave a message on our Google Voice number 1-949-873-4298. You can also check out our website at stampshowheretoday.com or follow us on Facebook or watch us on YouTube. And as always, keep collecting.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurse, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hi, this is Bob Prager with Gary Poser Incorporated, and we're in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey, and our philosophy of Gary Poser Incorporated is this. We would rather pay very fair prices on 9 out of 10 collections that we look at versus trying to just offer very low prices on 1 out of 2 and making a big score. That's never our philosophy. So if you want to be treated fairly, please give us a call anytime at 800-323-4279. And again, my name is Bob Prager.